I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. Rag Radio comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on Co-op 91.7 FM. And we're also rebroadcast now on WFTE on Sunday mornings at 10. That WFTE is in Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Rag Radio is produced in the studios of Co-op in association with the Rag Blog and the New Journalism Project. All of our shows are up as podcasts. You can listen to every show from the very beginning at the Internet Archive. Just go to Internet Archive and search Rag Radio. My colleague and producer, or engineer, whatever. What are you, Tracy? Tracy Schultz.
Man about everything.
Man about town. Thank you for being here with us today, Tracy.
My pleasure.
It's always fun. Okay. Author and sustainability advocate, Ellen LaConte. Ellen is a freelance journalist, a contemporary issues writer, a memoirist, the author of Life Rules, Why So Much Is Going Wrong Everywhere at Once, and How Life Teaches Us to Fix It. Ellen is also a regular contributor to the Rag Blog, and if you want to go to the Rag Blog, it's theragblog.blogspot.com. You can read her article, When Too Big to Fail is Too Big Not to, and you can find other articles by Ellen LaConte. Ellen, welcome to Rag Radio.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be there, and it's interesting, Thorne, to think of this being broadcast in both Austin, Texas, which is sort of one of the most forward-thinking cities in the country, and up there in Mount Cobb, Scranton. I used to drive through there a lot on my way from Maine to North Carolina, and I would have thought that was not one of the most forward-looking places, but I guess they're catching on.
Well, this is it's a community radio station. They're an all-volunteer, just like we are. We're an all-volunteer station.
Yes.
We've been around for a while, though. We're cooperatively run. And
a lot of the leading curve things have been around for a while in Austin and in places like where I live in North Carolina. We're still trying to catch up.
Well, I think you're right up there. Okay, here's what I want to do first. Now, I know there's a lot of things for us to talk about, and I know that your book, Life Rules, partial description of it says, why is so much going wrong everywhere at once? The global economy has gone viral. It is ravaging Earth's immune system, triggering a critical mass of mutually reinforcing environmental, economic, social, cultural, and political crises that are compromising the ability of Earth's human and natural communities to provide for, protect, and heal themselves. The prognosis, if we keep doing what we're doing, what we've been doing, life will last, but life as we know it, and a lot of us, won't. Okay, something that's pretty interesting is that, and we want to talk about the Occupy Wall Street movement, because I know that you think that that's significant, and you have some opinions about what's happening with it, and where it came from, and where it's going, and I think we have a slightly different take on what's happening with it right now.
Mm-hmm.
But before that...
And I'll be happy to hear yours.
Well, you will hear it. We can. Some give and take is always fun. You wrote a few weeks back an article that we ran in the Rag Blog called... It was an open letter to Stephen King. It was called A Really Scary Story for Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about, and in that letter, you said, this is to Stephen King, you said, most of your books are too scary for me. They give me nightmares. Call me oversensitive. But when my son was a teenager and I still lived in Maine, he devoured your books. And you said, well, he's almost 35 now, and along with a lot of other young Americans, he's wondering what our generation was thinking all these years. We didn't notice we were spending down his only meaningful inheritances, a habitable planet, the company of congenial species and functioning ecosystems, and enough natural resources to get a living on in an economy that doesn't devour its young. So your idea, what you were doing, your open letter to Stephen King was you had an idea for a very scary story for him. And
yeah.
you said they don't get it, that we can't keep treating species like pop-up critters in a state fair shooting gallery and ecosystems like toilets and all-you-can-eat buffets. They've got it in their heads that some magic how our population can keep growing and so can the economy, as if we had a whole bunch more Earths we could import stuff from when we run low. So your idea for a story was to deal with a virus that is attacking planet Earth that's somewhat kind of parallel to the HIV virus, and you said that you thought that would be a wonderful story. Tell us about that virus. Tell us about how that works. I thought that would be an interesting way to get into your sort of overview of what's happening.
All right. Well, I think I'll cut to the. I'll actually use my own book to answer that because this idea, Thorne, or this way of thinking about what a globalized economy. Capitalist industrial economy specifically, but a globalized economy has done to the capacity of communities, towns, cities, and ecosystems to be what we call resilient, to respond to change, prevent too much severe change from happening if possible, but kind of go along in an increasingly orderly, complex, but orderly self-protective fashion. In the way that the immune system does in the human body. This was triggered by Paul Hawkins' book called Blessed Unrest, in which he looks at what's going on in the world today and commented that 250,000 perhaps, nonprofit organizations and institutions that are dealing with homeless, food, poverty, injustice, health, indigenous peoples' issues around the world, that the people participating in those organizations and institutions and those organizations and institutions themselves function, he said, in a way that's sort of like antibodies in an immune system. They are rising to the occasion of helping to heal damage that's been caused. Well, that lit a light bulb in my brain, and I suddenly realized or thought that that's exactly what we're experiencing in a planet-wide, planetary, global way right now, is the inability of local communities, small towns, villages around the world, and of natural systems around the world to protect and heal themselves because the global capitalist industrial economy behaves on this planet now, because it is global, much in the way HIV behaves in the body. So a couple of examples. In the book, I give two pages to a comparison of HIV, human immune deficiency virus, with the global economy. Okay, so HIV is a package of genetic information, an RNA code for a particular type of virus. The global economy is a package of socioeconomic information, a set of ideas about a particular kind of economic system, capitalist and industrial. HIV is held together by a protein wrapper that works like the coating on a pill to camouflage the virus, making it taste better, or at least not taste bad, to the human bodies it aims to infect, so that they don't reject it on first pass. The sugar coating that makes the viral global economy taste good and camouflages its intent is a capitalist ideology of perpetual growth and progress and universal prosperity, an easy sell to communities and nations that lack comparatively in material well-being. As a group, disease-causing agents like viruses have a name. They're called pathogens. As a group, the directors, managers, promoters, and primary beneficiaries of the disease-causing global economy have a name. They are called the powers that be, or simply the powers, that group against whose ways of operating, managing this economy, the Occupy Wall Street protesters around the world are now reacting. But here's the part, I think, where it really got to me, how close the similarity between HIV in the human body and the global economy on this planet are in their functioning. HIV invades immune system cells, disables their protective and healing capabilities, and reprograms them to make millions of copies of itself. After it has used up a cell's resources, its copies disperse to other parts of the body and other hosts. Captured cells and whole organ systems are destroyed in the process. The global economy persuades, buys, cajoles, coerces, and invades human and natural communities. It undermines their ability to provide for and protect themselves and reprograms them to support its growth and expansion instead. When it has depleted local resources, it moves on, leaving communities and nations in ruins. And this, that's just a few of the items from the list. But the essence, I mean, you get the drift. Essentially, we keep wondering why Washington isn't doing more. Well, it's partly that it's partly the issues of inequity and greed and the 1% that the Wall Street protests and the protests in Egypt and Libya and elsewhere in the Middle East and desert nations. It's partly about that greed and inequity and the powers at the top benefiting.
But it's also systemic, right?
Exactly. It is a systemic, it's a syndrome of conditions caused by an economy that does not understand it's operating, and no one's making it understand that it's operating on a finite planet, as AIDS operates in a finite human body. And at some point, the resources of that planet, this planet, are depleted to the point where the people that are protesting can't get what they're hoping to get from the protest.
Okay, this is no doubt a scary story where they're worthy of Stephen King. Stephen King usually has happy endings. How far along is this virus? How bad off are we, and what are our chances of surviving?
Okay, in HIV. People tend to use the two terms HIV and AIDS interchangeably, but they aren't actually interchangeable. The virus, for a long period of time, and so long as it can be stalled by a medical protocol, a cocktail of medicines such as are being used now here in first world countries and beginning to be used where they can be afforded in quote-unquote third world countries, so long as it can be stalled, it remains HIV. It is a virus, and it can be managed. There is a point at which, if it's not managed, if it's not stalled, if it's not held off, it becomes a terminal condition. That's when it becomes, in this analogy, that's when it's called AIDS. There is debate now about whether we are now in the Earth equivalent of AIDS, whether we've hit terminal condition, and therefore may not be able to do anything but forestall the worst, and at some point things as we know them, climate change being one of the biggest, like respiratory failure in a patient with AIDS, climate change being one of the biggest threats to us at this point, as Bill McKibben notes. I tend to think, looking at the trend of this, that we've been worsening rapidly, but that we haven't quite hit terminal condition yet. However, my concern is that we're counting on the powers that be who benefit from this, whether they are elected or in the financial sector or simply scraping their piece off the top. We're counting on them to fix the condition they've caused and still benefit from, and they aren't going to do it. And they couldn't probably if they wanted to. It's become too complex.
Okay,
it brings us back to what living systems do, which is where I take the book. What do living systems, natural systems, do to deal with this kind of issue? There are still things we can do.
It's interesting because Robert Jensen has been my guest on RAG Radio, and there's some similarities. In terms of taking all of these factors into account and seeing it as being a global problem, and one of the things, and seeing the economics and the climate aspects of being interlocking, interrelated. And one of the things he says that whatever politics we have going forward, it's at our own peril that we don't take into account what's happening with climate change and in general the ecological state of the earth.
Yes.
That wasn't exactly a question, but...
You didn't need to make it into a question. And Bob, I love reading him, and I love the way he thinks. And he's been very generous to me. He has supported the book and did a lovely interview of me that he posted on Energy Bulletin back in, April or thereabouts. And we think we write very differently. We have different language, different background coming into this work, but a very similar view going forward. If we do not look at the three, there are three converging forces. Either one of the three, or any two, or all three of them, which is what's happening now, occurring at the same time, and that would be the potential for economic collapse, which we are facing in a realistic way, looking at what's going on in Europe and what's going on in here, and the wavering Chinese economy that everybody hopes will bail everybody else out. We have the potential for economic collapse, the potential for a sufficient number of ecosystems to weaken or collapse, that they no longer provide the services we need them to provide us or the resources we need them to provide us, and climate change, which is probably the biggest, because that doesn't even count peak oil, which we can live, we can survive peak oil, but if the ecosystems collapse, the economy collapses, survival becomes problematic because it's a global economy and a lot of people would go under with it. If the climate changes as rapidly, I was at a conference this 2 weekends ago where I was giving talks and Bill McKibben was the keynote. It was convened by John Cobb, another amazing 40-year-long theologian, ecological, economic thinker and writer. And Bill McKibben was a keynote and present, and David Orr was there and several other fabulous speakers, and I was one of the subluminaries doing a workshop. And Bill McKibben has become, in this process of dealing with the Keystone Pipeline and 350.org, what I would call ascetic. He is so committed, so concerned about the fact that we are approaching 400 parts per million in carbon dioxide, and 350 is what the planet can tolerate. He doesn't see a positive outcome in terms of preserving anything we're accustomed to economically, politically, and in our lifestyles. But he, like me, sees that if we began to make some of the necessary changes, and this is where Bob is as well.
Substantial downsizing for one thing, right?
Exactly. Well, I have, I call it, and I'll just jump here.
We need to take a break in just a minute.
Okay, so I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. But in about 2 minutes, we're going to need to take our,
okay, that's
our first
right.
break.
I'll do this quick, and we can revisit it. I've been trying to find a way that's faster than the chapters or sections I use in my book to be able to talk about what it is we do to separate ourselves from this global economy. I call it 6 degrees of separation from a global economy. Drop back or drop out, and we'll revisit. Drop out or drop back. Downsize, diversify, decarbonize, dematerialize, democratize. All of them are viable at local and regional levels. None of them will get done at the global level.
Okay. Ellen LeConte, this is RAG Radio, and we'll be right back. I want to mention, by the way, if anyone wants to get in touch with us, either during the show, you can just you can email us, or later. We're ragradio@koop.org. Ellen LeConte, there's just so much to talk about, and at the end of the show, I want to talk about what you think people can do, because I think that's always extremely important, that we not, especially when we're painting a very bleak picture.
And there'd be hardly any point in painting such a bleak picture if there was nothing to be done. Why say it? If the train is going to bear down on you and run you over, then enjoy whatever you've got left, because there's no choice. But I think those of us that are doing this work are doing it because there are still choices. They just aren't going to get made by the people we usually look to make them.
Okay, I want to ask you now, you wrote a little while back, and you wrote an article and I believe this was in the Energy Bulletin, if I'm not mistaken. Becoming Legion, are the occupations a brief preoccupation, or the sign of a world-altering transformation? You say, we may be witnessing the next stage in the evolution of revolutions, one that could bring life-honoring, lifelike democratic powers, freedoms, and relationships to peoples around the world. You said it has the Occupy movement has catalyzed middle class, progressive, green, unionists, and environmentalists, along with college students and footloose under 30s. And its support is integrated people, genders, classes, ethnicities, races, and ages, if not yet all of their special interests, and despite their otherwise apparent differences. In an article that we just ran today, or I think I posted it yesterday in the RAG blog, when too big to fail is not, is too big not to. When too big to fail is too big not to, you seem to have a slightly more skeptical feel about what's happening with the Occupy movement. You said, like the powers that be on Wall Street and Washington and in the rest of the nations and the world's capitals and financial centers, that they, meaning the Wall Street protesters, believe in the global economy's ability to deliver them the goods, the resources, jobs, wages, and services they deserve and depend upon, if only the people managing it were more fair. And that's something we were touching on a minute ago. Do you feel that there's not that larger the sense of the larger picture in that movement?
I think there isn't, and I had hoped perhaps there was, but nothing that I've read coming out of the people that have sort of been on the ground, some of the journalists and ad hoc reporters and speakers for the movement have expressed any understanding either in New York or in any of the other protests, and I haven't, I mean, I can't generalize this too much because I haven't read every post or article that's coming out in all the newspapers in every location where this movement has sort of taken hold. Well, I'm not sure about movement, where this moment has taken hold. And there are a variety of different issues that seem to catalyze them in different places depending on what particular group organized the protest in any given location, but I have not yet heard a coherent, and they are the participants and those sort of ad hoc leaders of the various groups are very clear about not feeling that they need to have a coherent beyond consensus about what's happening on any given day on the ground, that sort of larger coherent here's what we're here for, that would turn it, for example, from the what happened in colonial America, when members of different colonies and different cities within different colonies, like Massachusetts, Connecticut, Virginia, they had different complaints with Britain. They had different complaints with their own colonial leaders. That finally catalyzed around the British government having control over all the trade and all the movement of money and all the decisions made. It became a coherent movement, a coherent set of demands, complaints. I haven't heard that happen yet, and I've heard, other than the ones that have been framed by adbusters and sort of fed to the group,
I want for you to tell us about, because a lot of people don't know about adbusters and about the role they okay. played in sort of kicking this off, although obviously the Arab Spring and what happened in Europe and in other places around the world also had a major role in kicking this off.
Yeah, that lit adbusters has had this kind of activity in mind for some time. Well,
go ahead and do that. I wanted to respond to what you were saying about Wall Street.
Yeah, from my perspective, from what I'm reading and paying attention to, what I've seen is it is what the other alternative I offered for what this might turn out to be, which is the flash in the pan. You know, it happens. And Americans, our attention span, we're so busy, so overwhelmingly overloaded with information, data, news feeds, banners, you name it, most of which are not tied together or analyzed in any coherent way except maybe sometimes by NPR and a few really brilliant writers that still work in magazines like The Atlantic or Harper's or wherever that are trying to sort things out. Apart from that, most of us are just getting a barrage of information, and we burn out. So it has already lost the excitement factor that it had for a period of time.
You don't think that has anything to do with the mainstream media's reporting of it? Think we really know?
Oh, because it's very hard for the excitement factor to become for it to be covered as something coherent.
What I think, and I'll just say this briefly because I'm much more interested in knowing from, because I've been, we've been running a lot of articles. I've been getting a lot of feedback through listservs, through aggregators, through all kinds of reporting from all over the country. And I personally think it's moved into another phase, and that I think it's a movement, and it's a spirit, and it's something that that it's too soon for it to have demands that would be real, and that I think that that's all coalescing. And I know I've participated in a couple of, like, on the grassroots level, there's all of these like teach-ins and meetings and workshops and things going on. And I've sat in on a couple of those that were here in Austin that were just extremely high level, and in which people I think really do have a larger sense of the picture. But I don't think they're a larger view. But I think that it's just too early. I mean, I think stuff is still happening all over the place, and there's a lot of stuff that people have to sort of take into account and deal with, because, you know, there's the problems of violence that happened in Oakland, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that the media ignored it at first.
Exactly.
Then there was sort of an eruption of media coverage, and then now that there's, you know, unless there's action, unless there's violence or something, the media is ignoring it.
Exactly, I agree totally with what you're saying. And I think if we take, I don't think this will go away over the long term, because the circumstances that have caused, triggered this on our shores, in our country, that have triggered what I call this chaos creep from the Arab Spring to this country, that sense of things not getting done, of things not being fair, of what's expected, what we expect for our lives, what we expect from our politicians, what we expect from our jobs or expect to have jobs, these things falling away from us at a great rate. I think the teach-ins, the a kind of momentum, a simmering, is going to continue, and at some point it's going to boil. I think that's going to take some time yet, because we tend to be, many of us, the majority of Americans, still tend to be pacified far more easily than they ought to be, mostly not due to their own fault at this point, but due exactly, as you say, to the media treatment and the media dumbing down of issues and of the American thought process. I think there will be a point when this takes hold. I think a moment when it could have become more coherent in terms of understanding and stating a systemic problem that's not just about injustice, but that's about systems that are no longer sustainable. That's the part I think hasn't happened this round yet.
Well, it clearly is an experiment in genuine anarchism, in that it's the organization is all horizontal, and leaders, there's no way, I think, that at this point there's nobody who can speak for it, and which is interesting, the fact that it has evolved in that way. And I think that obviously it's going to have to take on more structure and have to.
Well, and I think evolve. This is it's interesting to me because in my book, in Life Rules, the reason that that title is what it is that ultimately the largest economy, and in a way political economy, but not in a human way, the largest economy on this planet is not the global economy, even though we like to think it is. It's not any human economy. The largest economic system, the largest provider of goods and services, is the biosphere, life itself. If that changes too much, if life has to make too many adjustments, which it would under climate change, for example, then it's not going to be able to deliver to humans as well as many other currently happy species the things that they need to live. So if we want to learn what, and life has been, you know, working at this, learning these lessons, figuring out how to function, living systems have been figuring out how to work together, species have been figuring out to last for long periods of time. Over the last 4 billion years, this is a long experiment. We've only, modern humans are, 100,000, 150,000 years? We're still way at the bottom of our learning curve. And the teacher that would be the most appropriate teacher would not be Keynes or Milton Friedman or some other human economist that clearly didn't quite figure out yet that life is the biggest economy on this planet, but life itself. If we want to learn how to function on this planet in sustainable ways that can actually be relatively humane and remarkably democratic, we look to living systems. And living systems, when they're going through the kind of crisis we're going through, do exactly what's happening now with the movements. I didn't write that post yet. That's the next one.
Okay.
And that is, there is a period of chaos on the ground. It's absolutely natural in the literal sense of it's absolutely natural for there to be chaos, and then for people to begin to get to understand what's going on and to find ways of collaborating that become, over a period of time, more widely collaborative and coherent. And and we will learn what we need to do. We got to go through this mess first. But we need to take the mess seriously.
Okay, when we look at climate change, and obviously the climate change and the world economies are totally interrelated, and they
Absolutely.
One dictates the other. We have known, science has known for quite a while, that we were undergoing really heavy-duty changes in our climate. Global warming is not something we've just discovered. They continually realize that it's happening faster than expected. But it doesn't seem to matter, because we seem to be to do anything about it involves a lot of sacrifice.
Exactly.
And it seems like what happens is we just get into a state of denial, and we say, well, that's something that we can do later. But right now we need our cars and we need, blah, blah, blah. How do we just have to have some serious natural catastrophes to bring that home to people?
How can it happen
intellectually?
As our brains have evolved, our brains function in a way that tends to respond to the loudest noise, the worst cataclysm, and not to the incremental things that add up to it. And we have been, our government and our media, the powers that be, have so packaged this in a way that prevents it from being, for most Americans, as serious as it is. And even for the people whose whole cities and lives have been overturned either by a disastrous flood or a series of them, or tornadoes or a series of them, or drought or protracted drought, it's been presented in such a way by the major media, or not presented in such a way, as most people don't see this as proof of such a large, devastating global change that becomes the priority. I really think it will take a hit upside the head that will be very costly in human lives and in ecosystem survival.
And won't it take a global response?
Well, that would be...
Or the alternative is, do we have to just on the local, very, very local level, change our lives and change the way we interact?
We have to change the way we interact, and we have to adapt, exactly as living systems do when a regional or a local ecosystem is damaged by the failure, by a large-scale crisis like an asteroid strike or a protracted volcanic winter from volcanic eruptions that darken the sky for so long that everything goes cold. Every species, every place learns to adapt to that. And preparing to adapt would be proactive adaptation, which I don't know that that's even a, you know, those two may cancel each other out, but proactive adaptation is what would benefit most of us wherever we are the most. The global decision-making process is not going to occur soon enough or at the level of intensity that it needs to prevent substantial change in the way the weather works wherever we are. And adapting to the way the weather works wherever we are is the best thing we can do.
Okay. When we talked about greed, which is the one thing that has kind of come suddenly into the national vocabulary.
Yes. Again.
And yes, again. But it is seen as being the root of a lot of problems, and a lot of people believe, and I think that you probably believe, that greed is inherent, that our economic and political system tends to...
It feeds it.
It feeds greed, and that to succeed in our system, we feed the worst in humanity rather than the best in humanity.
Yes.
The worst instincts, the worst... responses. So we can't, how do we change that without changing the basic economic system, and how do we go about making that happen?
Well, I mean, that is the thing, I think, that gives me the most hope. That's happening all over the place. The organizations and institutions around the world, nonprofit organizations, Paul Hawken talks about, and his group called, a group he started of students, I think, young people, who are, and researchers who are, if you Google Wiser Earth, this group comes up, who are collecting the information about all these institutions and nonprofits around the world that are doing the good work. We have the transition movement here in England and in Europe. There are an enormous number, the relocalization movement, the new money, alternative currency movement. All of these and other.
The workers' cooperative movement,
yes,
I think, is extremely important. What's happening in Mondragon?
And this is really what I hoped to create, and I'm not well enough known, and I haven't had the book out long enough or figured out exactly the way to do this. But what I hoped to create with Life Rules was that larger context within which more people, more of us, more Americans, more people everywhere would begin to understand what the use is of all those organizations. They are, so long as they're operating individually, discreetly, distinctly from each other, as separate organizations biting off particular pieces of this problem and chewing on it, they will have less success than when we understand that they all work together. These are parts of the solution, and as in the immune system in the body, when they work together, then the whole system, the whole body is healed.
Do our new technologies make that more possible, do you think?
There are new technologies.
And I'm talking here about communication technologies and social networking technologies.
Absolutely, so long as there is an electric grid to support it, that certainly is going to be, that is, living systems operate, natural systems operate by what could be called acquired intelligence. They have chemical ways, for the most part, of sharing information about the status of their weather, their soil, whatever their living environment is, and sharing that information is what allows them to survive wherever it is they are in the world, whatever kind of ecosystem they're in. They become smart not as individuals, but because they pool their intelligence. And the extent to which we pool our successes and failures about relocalizing, downsizing, decarbonizing, dematerializing, sharing those experiences by whatever means, face-to-face, locally, and I think that may be the one thing that after peak oil and economic wavering and collapse, the one thing that may remain globalized and probably should is information about what works and what doesn't on a changing planet.
Okay, and we're part of that information exchange right here.
You sure are.
I'm Thorne Dreyer. My guest is Ellen LeConte, and this is RAG Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG. I hear it. I hear it coming. You hear it, Tracy? Democracy there.
For sure.
We hear it. We've been hearing we hear it in the drum circles. Ellen LeConte is an independent scholar, organic gardener, this is in her own words, gregarious recluse, and freelance writer living in the Yadkin River watershed of the Piedmont bioregion of North Carolina. She is the author of Life Rules, Why So Much Is Going Wrong Everywhere at Once, and How Life Teaches Us to Fix It. Ellen, one of the things that you wrote an article for the RAG blog that we ran in the RAG blog, called Finding Democracy in Unexpected Places. What can we learn from the lowly slime mold?
Well, you brought it right down to ground level and below there, Thorne.
Very lowly.
Talking about grassroots democracy, let's get down to the slime mold. Yeah, one of the things I found, and it's been very encouraging to me, is that although democracy is a word that means people's strength or people's power, something along those lines, depending on what Greek translation you get. So democracy has obviously, the term applies to what people do, but it's hard to come up with another term that would convey exactly that particular set of behaviors and relationships. So I've applied it, I call it organic democracy, to the behaviors that I and many others, increasing numbers of others, have begun to discover in living systems, in natural systems. And when push comes to shove, they will go through species all the way, going all the way back to bacteria and the lowly slime mold, will find ways...
By lowly, there's no value judgment intended.
I don't think the slime mold will rise up in ire at my having said that,
okay.
Although, gosh, I wouldn't want to swear to that these days about any creature. Going back as far as the first single-celled creatures, when extreme competition in periods of quote-unquote economic or environmental stress, when extreme competition was not working for them very well because they threatened to put themselves out of business, every other kind of species on the planet, except us at the moment because we think we can outthink how living systems work, every other kind of living thing has acquired, learned, and begun and practiced some sort of partnership, collaboration, sharing. Not because it was a nice thing to do, not because they were altruistic, but because it's the best way to survive over the long haul. And if your job is for your species to survive, which is true of most living things, then you kind of want to get the species into the next generation. So slime mold, these little algae kind of scattered all around in any given population, usually on something kind of slippery and wet in the soil, at the edges of the ponds, wherever. Slime mold operate as we do, as individual cells, individual algae, until there is a crisis of some kind, usually having to do with food supply. And rather than compete to the death, these little single-celled creatures somehow spread information about the stress that they're under, just as we hope that we're doing, and they converge. They gather together, and they turn from the collection of an aggregation of individual cells into another creature, the one we call slime mold. And like a little sort of slug, these individual cells now cohabiting, now glued to each other, travel until they find a place where they can provide themselves with enough to live on. And they throw up a little tower, and at the top of the little tower is what almost looks like a little light bulb, and that little light bulb scatters spore, single-celled creatures, and those single-celled creatures, back to being individuals again, make their way in the new and more congenial setting. Well, this is a lesson for us. We can turn ourselves into something else. Instead of being individuals competing to the death, we can turn ourselves into communities, true communities, of purpose, place, and partnership that learn how to move through this chaotic time period we're living in. And there are communities all over the country. There, Austin's a prime example of a city with communities that are working on these issues already.
You by the way, just to one more point about the whole the slime mold question, the slime mold issue, that you talk about animals that are probably members of the animal kingdom that we can relate to a little more closely, and that's like red deer and gorillas and African buffalo herds and some of the ways that they work together. And of course, we've all, you know, it's studied in school some of the ways that there's cooperative work among various species. But, I mean, that's a fascinating way of looking at it.
It is. I mean,
democracy on the grassroots level.
Right. We tend to think that we're it in terms of democracy, even though we haven't gotten all that far with it yet, as far as we might. But many of these non-human beings, entities, have learned behaviors and relationships that are far more well-coordinated, cooperative, generous with each other, equitable than we are. There are many cues, many techniques, many practices we can learn from other than human species.
And I think the scientists believe that we have, that the humans, the psychologists and the philosophers believe that humans have many qualities, many positive and negative qualities, but that the nature of the system that we exist in tends to influence the ones that thrive, and that our system tends to the competitiveness and the greed are things that tend to. Okay, here's we're coming down. We've just got about 10 minutes left. What I want to talk about what we can do, what people can do, and there's more than just trying to spread the word or getting involved in demonstrations. One of the things you wrote about, you wrote an article called "Garden as If Your Life Depended on It," and I think you sort of think in a sense, in a larger sense, maybe it does. Is that one of the things we can do on a grassroots level?
Well, when we think about we have a very basic set of things that we actually need to live, and even if we have them, we can live a fairly high quality life, but it's not a life full of the sort of stuff or busyness or convenience that we're accustomed to now. But obviously, among the things we need as a species, as most species do, to live, food, water, preferably some sort of shelter or clothing protection from the elements. The food provides our energy. The place that people seem, and it's clear in the slow food movement, in the local food movement, in the support your local farmers movements, that one of the first things that comes to people's mind when they start thinking about taking more responsibility for providing for themselves what a globalized economy may not provide for them much longer is food. And if the activities in which we would have to engage to make the right sorts of decisions about farmland, the use of backyards in the suburbs, ways of turning cities into gardens, protecting our soil, building soil, improving soil, acquiring recycling water, preventing pollution, the decisions we would have to make in every corner of this country, not to mention everywhere else in the world, but in every corner of this country, to be able to provide healthy, clean, nourishing, sufficient food to most or all Americans would bring us together in ways that would help us solve almost every other problem that we will have to deal with if the economy and when the peak oil moments have occurred. If the economy collapses, and as we pass through the end of cheap, easy oil, cheap, easy resources, cheap, easy weather, the steps we would have to go through as communities, as neighbors, as bioregions to provide food would help us, prepare us to take all the other steps we need to take.
You know, one thing, when you talked about the fact that we're so oriented towards acquiring stuff, and it's true. That's what we think is important. That's what
we've been made to think is important. Shop till you drop it. You know, it's patriotic to shop.
But those of us who've ever been involved in community, what happens when people do acquire a lot of stuff is they don't really get happy. They just think they have to acquire more stuff.
That's right.
And those of us who've been involved in any kind of cooperative, collaborative kind of work, movement, efforts.
Like your radio station.
And like the experience that those of us who came up in the 60s really, but yeah, like this radio station. I think we find that there's a different kind of reward, and it's a much deeper and richer reward.
Absolutely. Paul Gilding talks about this in his book, The Great Disruption, as, you know, thinking instead of an acquisitive or gross material economy, thinking in terms of a happiness economy. There have been a number of people working on that issue for a long time, that we need to reframe what economic success looks like. And it begins in more and more to look like what I call, sufficiency. Many people have called sufficiency, or even subsistence, the ability to live on what you can produce and you and your neighbors and friends and people in your region can produce so that you can live and not only survive, but possibly thrive, and thrive in ways that are far more congenial, social, intimate, generous, kindly than the ways we survive, many of us now, when we're so busy trying to make the almighty dollar, which is worth less and less every day.
What other things can we do to build sort of that kind of alternative infrastructure to prepare for the collapse, to prepare for self-reliance?
I think one of the food is certainly a starting place, but one of the things that's required, and I'm just really beginning to do enough homework on this to even speak about it at all intelligently. I refer to it in my book, but it needs much more work on my part. This whole movement toward rethinking money, what it is, how it needs to be. I mean, we created money. The dollar is something that we created. Humans created monetary systems. We can create different ones that work for us and that work for the transition from global and carbon and fossil-fueled top-down pyramid-shaped 1% versus 99%. If we begin in groups talking about how we might reframe, recreate alternative currencies and different kinds of monetary systems up close to home, we could begin to move stuff around locally that right now we depend on money coming from someplace else to move around for us.
So we could actually have some kind of sort of value exchange or whatever that didn't depend upon others taking our money and betting each other on it.
That's right.
You can create
systems that the money that you create moves around in your community, the jobs stay in the community, the rewards stay in the community, what's produced stays in the community or in the region. Most of these are local/regional alternative money systems, and there's a wealth, anybody that's interested in that, there's a wealth of information just by Googling alternative currencies, local money systems, new money. Any of those will pop up an enormous number of experiments underway in rethinking and reinventing money so that it works for us.
And I know there's a lot of groups, and I know there are people here in Austin that are building communities based upon barter kind of systems.
Right, and barter is often a sort of a starter part of it, and there are ways of making that a bit more sophisticated. But the options are almost endless. The innovation possibilities are endless. And if that's a place that people begin, along with food production, all of a sudden, the possibilities fall into place of being able to take charge of the other parts of that, you know, need list, how we handle water, how we handle recycling, how we handle manufacturing so that materials are used again and again and again. Everything becomes easier if we're not waiting for that dollar to come from Washington or these days from some larger entity. Then we can begin to take charge. We can literally take control of our futures.
Of course, you were talking about Bill McKibben and the decision, I guess it was yesterday or day before, about the Keystone Pipeline, which was to hold off on it at this point, which was has to be seen as a major victory, even though it's still tentative, for the environmental movement. And that came on the heels of, and he was the really prime mover of that.
Yeah.
Several other things happened within the last few days. On Tuesday, there were a number of elections that showed that
yes, a lot of Americans are not standing with what we consider to be Tea Party issues or cutting each other off at the knees.
And I think that if the Occupy Wall Street movement has done anything, it's taken the conversation away from the Tea Party.
I think, and thank God.
Yeah.
For that. Yes.
Okay. All right. Peak oil. Our energy, and thinking about the oil pipeline, because we're all continually having to make decisions that are between our immediate comfort and our long-range needs. So many of our cities, our living situation, our living environment are built upon fossil fuel.
That's right.
Energy, and it's not enough to just say, well, we'll start, you know, we'll have mass transit, we'll start riding bikes. The kind of urban sprawl and sort of things, we've got to reorganize even the way we live together, right? And that's a major undertaking.
Massively. And it would be lovely if there were a simple solution to that. It's not, although food production is not entirely simple, it's a lot simpler than thinking about where energy comes from. This is one of those where the change is going to happen internally in our minds and in our behaviors, whether we like it or not. There will come a point where globalization of the kind we're used to, bringing foods or anything from far away, plastics. I have a page in the book that does what I call the ABCs of, it's a subtraction process, the ABCs of peak oil. And it asks the reader to, over a period of days, go through an exercise that takes away, for example, on day one, anything wrapped in plastic, and then we get anything made of plastic, and then we get anything that comes from more than 250 miles away. If you subtract all the way through this list, almost nothing that we have in this country is coming to us anymore.
Okay, Ellen, we're down to 2 minutes.
Okay, so
what can people do? Where can people go to find out more stuff and find out ways to get involved?
Every community has one or more of these movements in place at this point. Join that one or at least attend, sign up, get involved in one piece of this, whether it's food, economic justice, local energy issues, education. Start working with the people in your community, and you will find no matter which issue you start with, all of these begin to come up in conversation, and you work from there.
Okay, and they can find Life Rules at your website?
They can find Life, how to find it at my website, www.ellenlaconte, ellenlaconte.com. Life Rules can also be Googled at any of the internet, online bookstores, or ordered from any bookstore.
Okay, Ellen LaConte, thank you so much for being with us. This has been, we could do another hour.
and I wouldn't object because you asked good
We'll
questions.
Do it again sometime. Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This has been great. Thank you very much. Next week, singer, songwriter, author, actor, and artist Bobby Bridger. 2 weeks from now, UT Austin, University of Texas Government Professor David Edwards, and that'll be a good one. Both of those will be great. I want to thank you for being with us. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio.